Hello and welcome to Ancient Futures, where we ask who we were before thinking I am and discuss how revealing is healing. Today I'm joined by Francesca Ferrando, who's a philosopher of post-human studies at New York University. Now, I don't know about you, but that phrase tripped me up at first. So we start by discussing what post-human means and why it's not the same thing as becoming a cyborg or embracing extinction. Instead, it's a prompt for self-inquiry, which has lots of overlaps with mystical teachings. Francesca's new book is titled The Art of Being Post-Human, and the subtitle asks, who are we in the 21st century? However, as we explore, that's a timeless question, and it points towards some answers that make us rethink what it means to be human. So we talk about how everything's linked, and the power of awareness, as well as the importance of clear intentions, which leads us to contemplate, what do we want? A rather frightening question for many of us much of the time. Now, it's a very diverse conversation because Francesca dives deep to explain the philosophy while also relating it to spiritual insights, particularly on the subject of interconnection, as well as some personal reflections on how to make sense of the world we inhabit. So there is lots to chew over. You can find out more about Francesca at theposthuman.org, and for more about me and what I do, which is present ideas from yogic traditions, join me for a course at truthofyoga.com. Finally, for more about this podcast and to support it as a paying subscriber, for which I'll be immensely grateful, you can visit ancientfutures.substack.com. For now, though, let's get immersed in existential perspectives with Francesca Ferrando. So, Francesca, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It's such a joy and an honor to be here today. Thank you.
I don't know if I deserve quite that, but I'm honored to think that you might consider that, given that you've just written a book and, you know, you're, as it says, a leading voice on your website in the field of post-human studies. And your book here, The Art of Being Post-Human, repeats the same phrase. And for me, when I first saw that, we know each other through the internet, as it's easy to do these days. I was on the one hand fascinated and on the other hand slightly horrified, I have to admit. I thought post-human, it sounds a little bit like the whole project of uploading oneself to the cloud and becoming part of this sort of singularity that I sometimes feel like I'm entering every time I look at my webcam for too long. I wanted to find out more. So I was reading some of what you were writing and it sounded like actually the opposite. It sounded about as human in sense of, you know, deeply humane as it, you know, as possible to be. It wasn't sort of a techno blueprint for abolishing humanity. It was an attempt to try to see beyond some of the shortcomings of being a human, I think. But having read your book, I do have a deeper understanding of how you're using the phrase, but I wonder if you could just summarize quickly for everybody who's listening, because it's not a phrase that I had encountered until I saw your work.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so that's, we have the same book, The Art of Being Posthuman, Who Are We in the 21st Century? Hmm. Yeah, it's a work of love. I started to write this book during the pandemic. I was very involved in academia. I started to work on posthumanism around 2008. That was my PhD topic and dissertation. And at the time, the posthuman was really allowing me to rethink of the human. Once I entered the field, I realized that there was a lot of confusion. And in fact, your own perception at first of the title doesn't surprise me, because a lot of people connect the notion of the posthuman to what is more specifically transhumanism, which is fine. I mean, the posthuman is an umbrella term and has been used by many different thinkers and school of thoughts in the last, I would say, 20 to 30 years. And the reason why is there is so much confusion is because it is happening. It is a very alive discussion. it is not just the history of philosophy about, you know, what did Nietzsche said, or what did Adi Shankara really think. No, it is really happening. And it is, there is a multiple discussion, a pluriverse, if you want, instead of, you know, of a dialogue, a plurilogue on these topics. And so there was a lot of confusion. The first book that I wrote, Philosophical Posthumanism, was exactly to address that confusion. So what do we mean, you know, when we're talking about the posthuman in from the traditional transhumanism or posthumanism or anti-humanism? And so, yes, if you go to transhumanism, the idea that unfolds when you talk about posthuman is precisely what you're talking about. It's a stage of humanity that is not here yet. According to transhumanism, is going to come pretty soon. And an example that you brought is perfect to understand that condition. For instance, I think of mind uploading. So in mind uploading, you would have a machine where you would add uploading human consciousness. Now, genealogically and genetically speaking, the humans have been biological. So that kind of machine could not be defined just as human, because again, traditionally, historically, humans have been biological. On the other side, there is not a complete disconnection from humanity, because in that machine, human consciousness have been uploaded. So that would be a good example of a posthuman, a condition that is connected to the human, but is no longer human. So this is the approach of transhumanism to the posthuman. So the transhumans say, we used to be human. Some of us are transhuman now in the way we embrace technology, not just in the way we use technology, but almost as a magic key to the future. A lot of transhumanism, not all of them, but a lot of them come from an atheistic perspective. And so now that God is dead, now we have technology. Technology is going to solve it all. Now, so that transhumanism, I am a posthumanist philosopher, so it's also unfolding in this really alive discussion that is questioning who are we in the 21st century, not just as individuals, but specifically as a species. And so the answer that posthumanism gives is a very different one. Posthumanism does embrace technology, but not in a hierarchical way. So it's no longer, let's say, the God that has died, and now we have technology, now we have Google. God has died, but we have Google to take care of us and save us all. But it's not either the technological slave and the idea that technology should always serve us. On the other side, technology is seen as part of being human, together with ecology. The human is part of this planet, as part of this cosmos, as part of this dimension, not in any hierarchical ways. And so the posthuman, according to posthumanism, which is not the same as transhumanism, is a condition that can be embraced anytime. Actually, it's a condition that could have been embraced 1,000 years ago, that can be embraced 1,000 years from now. There is, you know, time is, in this tradition, is not linear, it's more like, if you want, a cycle, a spiral, it's curved, like space-time. And in that sense, the posthuman is a choice of awareness. Mm-hmm. And once we become aware of who we truly are, we understand that technology is neither our destiny, nor our master, nor our slave. It's none of that. It's part of who we are. And I like to bring the example of paleontology. In paleontology, the human as an animal is defined as that animal who creates tools out of tools. So on some level, technology itself defines us as human. So I would say that I'm also interested, of course, in all the transhumanist discussion. I think the transhumanism does a very good job about embracing possibilities with no fears. They are very excited. They have a lot of hope about what technology can unfold, which I think is beautiful. I also think that often that tradition is a little naive, is still based in the tradition of the European Enlightenment that came out of the Industrial Revolution, still in the idea that progress is linear, that, you know, can only get better, but it does not. And I think, for instance, of the case of the atomic bomb and the Second World War, when after the drop of the bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, there was a lot of philosophical discussion, and thinking, for instance, about France, where the question was, okay, well, technology is now at this point a progress or a regress. Once you create a bomb that can actually annihilate the whole species, that can kill us all, is it a progress or a regress? So I would say that, of course, if we're getting outside of a linear paradigm, is neither a progress or a regress, is a possibility. And in that sense, I would not use technology as the next God outside of us who can save us. I believe more in a, if you want, panentheistic approach, or I really like the notion, for instance, of non-dualism, for instance, Advaita Vedanta, where the Brahman and Atman are one and the same. I like, that resonates a lot with me. Everyone is different. But I believe that understanding really gives us so much freedom of creativity. And in that sense, technology is an unfolding of poiesis, of existential creativity. And in that
could
sense,
could I just jump on that word just for 1 second? Poiesis, that's one of those terms that I remember from my student days, not understanding like semiotics and postmodernism and other such things that were doing the rounds in the 1990s. Could you just clarify that for us? If I understood correctly, it's a reference to this sort of creative emergent potential. And it seemed that that's what you were referring to. There's a little line I made a note of. You said in the book, technology isn't something we use, but something we are. And so it seems to be something about relating to reality and the creative potential in that. So I wonder if you could clarify that for us.
Absolutely. In order to clarify that, if that's okay, I would weave in a philosopher who didn't have an ethical biography. In any ways, Martin Heidegger. Martin Heidegger was an unrepentant Nazi. He had sexual affairs with his students, so not someone who has a very good biography. But I believe that in the field of philosophy of now, that's important to say, because there are no heroes. People who can contribute to a field but still damage other people in other fields, like in their living dynamics.
Believe me, in the yoga world, we are very familiar with that.
You are so right, Daniel. You are so right. So, so told that he did have this unethical biography. I believe that Martin Heidegger contributed immensely to the field of technology, of philosophy of technology. And in that sense, I would like to bring a text, not to be pedantic or, the professor, but a thing that really clarifies this question about poiesis. So within Martin Heidegger, he wrote this essay, The Question Concerning Technology, in 1947. He published in 1949. And in this text, he was really fascinated about what is technology. So, he asked, what is technology? And a lot of people think that he was a Luddite, he was against technology. But he was not. It is true that he, moved to write in the Black Forest in Germany. So he was, writing in a deep place of, if you want, not technology in the sense of the way we think today, was like in the forest. He would cut his own wood, probably a couple of books in his cabin, and that was it. And so he wrote this this text about what is technology, which I believe is really deep. And so, when he asks the question, he says there are two meanings. One is a tool, and one is an activity, a human activity. And I would say that everyone would agree with that. No one would say, well, technology is not a tool, or technology is not a human activity. But he says, but is that enough to defy technology? And so, there was something that for him, those two definitions, although they were not wrong, they were not enough. So being a philosopher that was trained also in the classics, specifically in Latin and Greek, he went back to the roots of the term that came out of Greek, techne. And he realized something very interesting, that in the Greek narrative of techne, in fact, technology comes from Greek, techne, and logos, technology, and logos, the discourse on techne. But then if you look at what does techne mean? And techne, it's really, the ability of doing something, the craft, the craftship of something. You're really good at doing something. You train with someone, maybe in the ancient time you would go and learn pottery, or in music, you learn how to play an instrument. So you really craft it in something. But then, in the ancient Greek world, this term techne would always be associated with two other terms. One is episteme, which means science, scientific knowledge, more specifically, which is still very much a connection that we see nowadays. So, think of the field of science and technology studies. There is no surprise there. Okay, science and technology go well together. Now, the third layer is a layer that we completely forgot as a society, but the ancient Greeks had it very clear. And it was specifically poiesis. And poiesis is something that you can define as the moment of creativity that cannot be controlled. In fact, the Greeks would use this metaphor, which I think is brilliant. And it's the blooming of a flower. So it's the moment where the flower blooms and no one can control that. But it's extremely beautiful. It is a moment of creativity and creation. And think of a lot of society. Think, for instance, in Japan, where they have the cherry tree blossom festivals, waiting for the cherry tree to blossom. And also in China, a lot of traditions of waiting for the flower to bloom. Again, there is no way we can control that. Think of a moment of, let's say that you're very skilled at playing sitar or a saxophone or whatever instrument you play. You studied for years and you know all the scales, you know everything very well. And you know how to play music. Now you meet other musicians and you start improvising. And what comes out of the improvisation, that you're not following any script or anything, you record it. And yet, then, you know, one day later, you listen to that. That is a moment of poiesis, where you have your craft, you know how to play the instrument, but what comes out of your interaction with others, what comes out of the moment is just creativity. It's something you cannot control. It's something that surprises you. So there is this aspect of surprise that comes out with poiesis. And so we can also connect poiesis to, for instance, the tradition Hindu cosmology of Leela and the cosmic game. And in the cosmic game, a game itself cannot be controlled. Otherwise, there is no fun in playing any game if you already know the script and if you already know what is the game itself. There must be the moment of surprise. Who is going to win? That's why you play the game. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, poiesis really connect to all this tradition, even if you want to go to tradition that have maybe a god separated from the creation itself is an activity of poiesis, is a moment of delight, of creativity, of bliss. Satchitananda also again, for instance, in Advaita Vedanta. So I would say that poiesis sounds like a big term, but it's everywhere. If if it's snowing and you're outside and you look at a little snowflake, that snowflake is perfect. And that snowflake itself is going to, to exist in the palm of your hand for probably 5 seconds. But if you look at it melting, it is in a perfect shape. Or if it's raining and you look at any drop falling on anywhere, the drop itself is going to create these riddles in the water. And those are perfect. And that is also a moment of poiesis. Even the wires of your own computer connected to the wires of the electricity. And you go there 1 month again later and they are intertwined and in some different shape and there are some dust in the shape of a spiral. And you look at it at first you just see some dust and, oh, I have to untangle them. But if you look at the shape, there is something extremely beautiful. Usually there is some perfection there. So I would say that poiesis really is everywhere. Is in a leaf. Is in algorithms. It's everywhere. And of course, it's up to us to recognize that. And in that sense, wow. Technology is an act of poiesis. And in that sense, we cannot fully control technology. And to end with Heidegger, he says, technology is the danger of our time, but not because of technology. The only reason why we are in danger is because we think we can master technology. We think we can control technology. But technology is also a poetic act. And in poesy, there is no master and no slave. There is only this unlimited unfolding of creativity. And in that sense, we need to reconnect to this understanding of technology because that's what it is. And of course, there are human intentions. And of course, a lot of these platforms at the moment are based on human interest and profit of specific group of humans. Mm-hmm. But this is just really probably 5% of the whole picture. And if you think of the technosphere is going to be here after we get extinct as a species. And if I'm thinking about the technosphere, everything is the infrastructures, is the plastisphere, is the digital technologies, all of that. So I would really like to think of technology as much of a broader sense and think of that as an existential path that we are unfolding together. and with much more intention and much more awareness in the way we are unfolding it. Because whatever we put there, it's part of what is going to be unfolding, is becoming this techno consciousness that is being nourished at the moment by our own, the way we code, the way we look in the internet, the way we type, the way we interact in our emails. It's all feeding. The internet is all, that's how we are training the internet itself. So it's a connected endeavor. And in that sense, I don't think fear should be what is driving us, but awareness.
Thank you. Wow, that's a lot to take on board, but some key words jumping out at the end there that I really want to, you know, pause and allow to settle in. Awareness in particular, intention, and then this existential dimension of it all. And to come back to, you know, the concept of being post-human, which is the sort of theme hanging over all of that we're talking about, it seems to me then that the problem is, if we sort of have this question of who are we, that we don't really know who we are, and that we spend a lot of our time thinking that we know. And this is the starting point of yoga philosophy, to say that it's not that we you know, have a problem of being completely ignorant, it's that we know the wrong thing and we think that we're, you know, on the right track. And as people, if we think we control things, we're mistaken. If we think we have all sorts of certainties about what it means to be a person, we're mistaken. So if I've understood correctly, the whole project of post-humanism in some ways is to undermine the sense of certainty that we have about whatever it is we conceive of as who we are, so that we're alive to the actual moment-to-moment reality of how we are in this endless web of co-creation of who we actually are in our relationship with everything. Is that right, or have I misunderstood?
Thank you, Daniel. I'm going to give you two answers to this. One is specifically post-humanism, and another one would be more of an existential post-humanism. So post-humanism itself is about understanding the human in the 21st century. And I like to do it to these three, let's say, categories, although they are to be conceived in no way, in any way, hierarchical or as closed categories. But it helps because, you know, I started again, I was mentioning 2008, and when people would ask me what is transhumanism, the answer is really, really easy. It is about enhancing the human, humanity plus. That's what the transhumanist wants. Enhancing the human through science and technology. Easy answer. Some people loves it. Some people hates it. But it's very clear. But when people would ask me what was posthumanism, it was hard because, you know, I come from the deconstruction. It come from all this post-colonialism, feminism, critical race theory. It was really hard to try to clarify what it is. So, you know, I used to say maybe the deconstruction of the human, but still that would not clarify anything, especially if people who do not come from the tradition of deconstruction. So, especially in the previous book, I wanted to clarify what was posthumanism, to give a little clarity, although again, that should not be in any way taken as a final answer. And so I use these three categories. I think they are helpful. The first one is thinking of posthumanism as a post/humanism, which means really understanding the human as a diverse entity, as a species. And on some level, you can think that biologically speaking, that's a very easy answer because a species itself cannot be homogeneous. Otherwise, you don't no longer have a species. To have a species, you need constant diversity and diversification. That's why you constantly have variation at the genetic level. Even two clones are not exactly the same because of epigenetic changes. So I would say that the first understanding, of course, you can think, well, that's nothing new. It's been developed since the 70s. Okay, we are not one, we are many. Let the subaltern talk and all this understanding, which is true. It is nothing new of posthumanists to say that, but it is one of the understanding. To be human, we cannot homogenize the human in one single entity talking for everyone, because everyone is different, although we are one. And in this, I think that other traditions that maybe are not based on mainstream Western understanding is that one and two, they don't have to be completely separated, that one and many can be together, can be at the same time. Again, Brahman and Atman being one. So maybe it's a hard concept that one and many are not antithetical. But at the level of the species, that I think is very understandable. Look at us right now. We are two humans talking, and none of us is more human than the other, or all the people listening to us. We're all humans, and there should be at least no one that should be given granted the crown to say, okay, now you are the real human, the other one are subhumans. We understand that that has been used politically, economically, to use others for some groups' profits, but that's not really who we are. We are one species, and in order to be a species, we need to be diverse. So that is the first understanding. Again, it's not hierarchical. The second one is a post/anthropocentrism. And this is, I think, really the need of this time, to understand that the human is not longer, we can no longer understand the human in a hierarchical position compared to other species, either biological or not. But we can step for now within the biological realm. It might be easier for people to grasp it. So for instance, in the era of the sixth mass extinction, where thousands of species are getting extinct every year because of human action, this extinction is also reflecting on us. In fact, at the moment, the only reason why we could get extinct is human action. On one side is climate change, based again on anthropogenic causes, so caused by us, and other ones, for instance, could be a nuclear war. So we are in a mindset. I cannot generalize. I know that some people are not. A lot of native epistemologies do not separate the human from the geos, the earth. Think of Pachamama. Think of a lot of tradition in which the human is seen as, if anything, as the carer of the land, not the owner of the land. But I would say that a lot of industrial, post-industrial societies that come out of these acceptance of the industrial revolution as a paradigm that we should all just in which we are and place the human in separation from the earth, because from the earth we extract resources, labor, energy, whatever we need, because we are not that. Now this understanding is a very limiting understanding, because it is bringing us to a point where one of the main causes at the moment of human diseases is, again, human actions, is pollution. Cancer is one of the main causes and worse, one of the main diseases, for instance, in so-called industrial and post-industrial societies. And cancer is mostly caused by a polluted environment, and also a polluted inner environment, the food we eat, the air we breathe, the way we think. This disbalance in which we find ourselves is not just that we have separated us from the earth, so now the earth is in trouble, but we are not, because we are part of the earth. I like to write in my book part when the P is in parentheses, P art, the art of being part of something. And so in that sense, I also like this metaphor from Alan Watts, who was a philosopher training in many different traditions, including Zen. And he describes the human as an apple, like literal apple, that come out of an apple tree. And so he says, we never think of the human as an apple, but we are fruit of the earth. We literally are born out of the earth, like an apple is born out of the tree. And so when we start to think in that way, there is no way we can just take from this other body, this macro body that is not us. And so when we start to, really understand who we are, and that's where I'm going to go to the second part of my answer to your question, is that we are, micro bodies into macro bodies. It's almost like the Russian doors that you kick open and open. There is the smaller, smaller, and then the bigger, bigger. And in that sense, our macro body is the planet, is the biosphere, is the cosmos. And ourselves are macro bodies for instance, our biota, all the microbes that live in our body, and all the bacteria that live in our brain, in our guts, and who makes who we are. In fact, we are healthy or not because of the balance for instance, of our biota in our body, to the point that now scientists are saying even consciousness may be the result of these biota interacting in our own bodies. So when
and that's another really creative, if I might jump in there, one of your other, you know, you've got some lovely ways of playing with words in this book. Another coinage, I don't know if it's yours originally, but is to write this word biome as bio hyphen me. So that has this kind of whole connotation to something embodied about the whole experience of this interconnected web. So sorry, please.
You're so right. You're so right. The bio me. You're right. Yeah, exactly. So when we start to think of us as multiverses, so that, you know, I'm not just these lines that go through my hands and through my head and through my legs, but I'm going to start to expanding. And so I am this room as well, because I'm breathing the air in this room. And I'm also actually this earth, because without this earth, I would not be here. Actually, at the moment, the only planet in which humans can live the way we are is planet Earth. It's true that humans are trying to migrate outside of the Earth, but at the moment, there is no other planet in which we can actually survive the way we are. And then if I go inner and I think, you know, all these billions of entities that live inside of me, who are me? They're not separated from me. And they are in my micro me, my micro bodies within the macro. So then it really, the pictures start to be very different. And so I want from here to shift to, the third layer. Okay, so this was the second layer in which we are really to understand the human not on the top of any hierarchy, but being part of everything. And I believe that that's why we're still around. I got really fascinated by studying the Paleolithic time, an era that we never study, for sure not in philosophy, even in history. Maybe people study that it is like one or two classes in 5 years. It's something that we don't study. But it is 99% of our history as a human species. And we never studied that. And once we studied that, we realized that probably that's why we're still around. It's not because we have been, as in the last 5,000 years, you know, with the beginning of urban setting and borders and war and slavery, that all start when we started to be, when the nomadic life ended and we started to be sedentary. By the way, I'm not judging history, and I'm not saying that was better than now. In no way. I just want to be clear on this. But I also want to say that to my perception, the reason why we're still around is because for 99% of our history, we could not conceive ourselves in separation. When you are nomadic and you move around, if I go to an area and I eat all the mushrooms or I eat all the plants and I come back six months later, I'm going to be starving because I depleted the earth. I took too much and the plants could not come back. I'm going back and I'm going to be starving. If I kill all the animals, all the bisons, I'm going to go back in that area 1 year from now. There is no animal left. I'm going to be starving and I may die. So the 99% of our life, the human did not consider themselves in separation. If you look at the beautiful carvings in caves, the knowledge of the environment, which of course it was not considered as an environment. If anything, if you think of the Chinese environment where the human is always very small in ancient classical Chinese painting, the human is super small and the environment is 99% of the picture. So if you want to think of that kind of environment, when the environment is not the background, there is no background. There is never just a background. So then I can be okay with that. So in that sense, if you look at the carvings, these people knew their environments to the T perfectly because the human could not be separated. Now then we have a shift with agriculture, with urban setting. Again, I'm not judging history in any way, but we start to have the illusion of being independent from the environment. Now we have our own seeds. Now we can get humans to work for us. And now maybe we can enslave humans, some humans to work for us. And then what about war? Oh, now I can get more land for my own tribe. Where in the past, tribe used to meet with gatherings to communicate because they were not at any top of any food chain. So they need to communicate. In fact, they think, scientifically speaking, one of the main hypotheses at the moment is that we did not get extinct during the ice ages because humans knew how to communicate really well beyond the tribes. So for instance, Neanderthals communicated very well within families and small communities. But the humans had these big gatherings, apparently maybe, you know, once every year. They were not happening so often, but they would happen, and they would gather and do, you know, arts, the poiesis, the poetic art, arts and paints and music, and sharing information. And so one of the hypotheses why the human is still alive after the ice ages, when most of the other human species got extinct, is specifically communication. It's not war. It's not that we were killing each other. And one of the first, archaeologically speaking, cases of war is found in the late Neolithic. There is no, at this point, evidence, archaeologically speaking, of war in any of the Paleolithic time. So I would say that probably we're still around, not because we were at war with each other or we were killing each other or we were like trying to enslave each other, but because we were very clear about being part of the whole, and because we were able to communicate and support each other. We care about each other. We loved each other. We helped each other. And then you want to help each other. So I would say that if we don't understand, you know, like if we don't go back to this wider perspective, not just me and my little family and maybe my nation and not the others, we could be at the brink of a species extinction. I would say that if we don't realize who we are, and if we keep going in this more and more from the earth and more and more from each other, it could get to the end of the human. And again, here also I'm not judging. Some people are very happy about it. Some people are very depressed about it. I am none of them. I think that you get where you are. If I have a cancer in my lungs and I keep smoking, most likely I'm going to die. But maybe if I stop smoking and maybe I start to heal myself, I may not. So I would say that if we keep going in this pattern where we don't want to realize that we are living in the Anthropocene, that we are living we are co-creating an ecological disaster, then it's possible that the human eventually get extinct. And then, you know, there is a transformation. There is never death anyway. There is only transformation. And so there are going to be other species that are going to unfold. And so the last layer of the post-humanism, it would be post-dualism. And this, I think, is a more of an existential journey that I don't think any specific time is going to realize that. I think it's a more of a is the path of awakening, if you want. And it could be an individual path, it could be collective, it could be species path, but it is the full understanding at the end of who you are. And it is a completely non-dual approach. But I call it post-dualism because we do come from very dualistic societies, from very dualistic mindsets. And so it is very hard having been cultured in very dualistic ways to just jump to be non-dual. I think first it's very important to declutter ourselves from a lot of categories and then play around with categories. It's not that you need to just negate everything about your culture, but realize that they are shifting. They are play around with us. Don't take them too seriously. Don't take your nationality too seriously. Don't take your gender too seriously. Don't take anything to say. Play around with enjoy your life and just play around and know who you are. And so I don't know if I have the time to go into the second question. Let me know.
Because go on, just go on quickly.
Are you sure? Okay. Yeah. Quickly is not possible.
In which case, then, before you go there, I'll add one more dimension to it, which I think is probably what's coming anyway. I hear there are a lot of echoes of Eastern philosophy. And I know from reading your book that you don't just quote people like Alan Watts, but you refer specifically, in fact, one of the earliest references in the book is to Thich Nhat Hanh. One of the ways you've written the book, which I was going to ask you about just sort of structurally, is to have these little hashtag headings. And I was curious as to why the selection of hashtags when it's not actually a hypertext and I can't click on them and get more. But obviously that's a symbolic gesture. But one of the first hashtags is into being. And that's this idea that Thich Nhat Hanh very skillfully, I think, anglicized and made accessible, which relates to this dance between diversity and, you know, connectedness, and the fact that there are, you know, two of us here having a conversation, but we inter-are through the medium of our conversation. And actually, at some point, there's no distinction between us because the ideas are firing backwards and forwards and they're coming at us from everything we've read and experienced and suddenly we're part of the soup again, and yet, you know, there's still me talking to you and you talking to me. So it's a really nice image. And I wonder, when you talk there about awakening into who we are, how much of this is actually dependent on mystical experience by whatever means, whether it's through a spiritual tradition, psychedelic substances, moments of, you know, serendipitous wonder in a natural surrounding, whatever it might be. How important is that to this shift in perspective?
A great question and what a great insights, Daniel. Yes. So this would be the answer to the third part, post-dualism, is that, and that's why I say is a temporal beyond any space and time awareness, which relates perfectly to all mystical traditions. And I love studying. I mean, I'm a scholar and I study the, I would say, all the written tradition that we have at the moment. And I would say that all of them, from any context you name it, have mystics, and all the mystics say the same thing at the end. It doesn't matter if they are Sufis from the Islamic tradition or Christians from the Middle Ages or Hindus, it doesn't matter. At the end, they all say the same thing that, you know, you can call it with different names. God is within, that the inner is the outer, that the micro is the macro, is this reflective mirror. But they all say the same thing. That is, to me, is the truth, if you want to call the truth. It's a big term that I don't personally like it so much, but maybe that's exactly who we are. Maybe that is better, especially answering to the question of the book, who are we in the 21st century? And if you want, you can get rid of the 21st century, and that answer is beyond any space and any time. That's who we are. We are everything or we are nothing. You know, you can go either way. You can go Advaita Vedanta, we are everything, or you can go Zen, we are nothing. It's still the same understanding. And so I really like the notion of interbeing, Tignatan. I'm very happy you asking me this question, because yesterday I was just looking at the clouds, and I live upstate New York, and the nature here is sublime. It's extremely beautiful. And I was actually it was 2 days ago, and I was just laying down and looking at the clouds. It was a very cold day, and the sky was super bright, and there were these huge, huge clouds that kept shifting and changing. And one of the saying of Thich Nhat Hanh is that a cloud doesn't die. And in fact, there is also a beautiful documentary about him. The title is exactly, A Cloud Doesn't Die. And I remember when he passed a couple of years ago, I remember, you know, watching the whole ceremony. I was connected online through their website. And there was this energy, this love. You didn't feel that he died. You know, you felt the energy was going on, actually stronger than ever. And so yesterday was 2 days ago, I was looking at these clouds, and I was like, cloud doesn't die, it only transform, and the shapes are all extremely beautiful, and there is no end of the cloud. And so I really like this notion of interbeing, because it is also very, very concrete. I like Zen that it's you know, Zen doesn't really necessarily like the intellectual tradition. Actually, in the Zen tradition, books are not really considered any teachers. If anything, koan, very short, you know, strong sayings, and then reality as it is. And if you look at reality as it is, which is also in general Buddhism, you realize that you are never just yourself. For instance, Thich Nhat Hanh brings the example of a book, and he says, you know, there is no book without the trees, because the trees is where you get the paper from, and there are no trees without water, and there is no water without clouds, and there is no clouds without the sky, and you keep going until you realize that there is never a thing that is just on its own, just fully independent, fully autonomous. And that's also who we are. If you think about our genetic makeup, we are not just us, we are all the people who came before us. And if you really go back, all the bacteria that we were, I mean, we are already everything, just at the biological level. Not to mention the food that we eat, the water that we drink, the air that we breathe. And I was teaching Thich Nhat Hanh, I think it was like 1 month ago, and it was a big snowstorm. So we had to have I teach at NYU, and so we had to have the class online, because they closed NYU for the day. And it was very interesting, because, you know, one of the students said, one of the exercises they had to do to understand interbeing was just observing, taking a super slow walk, you know, walking meditation, and observe. And so this student took a very, very, you know, slow walk, and she was observing the snow. And all of a sudden, it hit her that snow was going to become her, because that snow was going to go into eventually the water that she was going to be drinking. And all of a sudden, she had this realization, oh, this is not just snow, this is me. And I thought it was really beautiful. It was so real. I was like, oh, now you see who you are. You are that snowflake in all its perfection that eventually is going to become who you are at that material level. And so interbeing, it's a very real notion that there is no being without the inter. And also if you think of post-humanism, think for instance of Karen Barad, the idea of intra-action, intra-relations. The relations are never just, there is never just a relata at the point A or point B. Point A or point B only always exists through the relation that they are in. And so I believe that this understanding is really at the core of who we are. I believe that it was at the core of our understanding as a species throughout the Paleolithic time, where it was very clear that we were not separated from everything else. And then I think we started to play the game of separation, which is a possible game. I think once you play games, you can play any game. And so this would go a little more into the answer that I would give you from an existential perspective, if you want to call existential posthumanism, about, well, do we know who we are? And my question is, how can we not know who we are if we are this? How can we not know? It's almost impossible. There is no way we cannot know who we are. And so the question is why we struggle so much. Why we struggle, some people throughout all their life, and if you believe lifetimes, some people through lifetimes, keeping, you know, like the ignorance, the avidia, not knowing. And so I like very much this understanding of, I'm going back to Leela, the cosmic game, because when I was writing the book, I was very much towards the end. And all of a sudden it hit me. I was like, oh, that's why most of the time we don't know who we are, or we think we don't know who we are, is because it's the rule of the game. It's almost like if you're playing hide and seek, and if you, you know, if you don't play the game, if you're not into the game, if you are thinking, oh, this is just a game, you're not going to play hide and seek. You're not going to feel the adrenaline of being found. You're not going to be running so fast, you know, so that the other person is not going to see you. You need to be full in the game to play the game. Otherwise, there is no game. And so if you want to go through this Advaita Vedanta understanding that this is a cosmic game in which we are everything. We are the director of the act. We are the actor and actresses. We are the electricians. We are the stage. We are the audience. We are the props. We are everything. If you are in that tradition, then of course you need to have a rule of ignorance. You need to play the game of not knowing. Otherwise, you're not going to play the game. Otherwise, why would you play the game? And so there is the understanding that once you become part of this play, or think of this as a playground, and you want to play, you need to be part of the game. There is also always the option of remembering that it is a game, especially when you realize that the game doesn't suit you anymore. For instance, I ran so much, now my heart beats too much, I'm tired, I'm sweating, I'm done with hide and seek. I need to stop. I need to stop, sit, breathe, drink some water. That game is done. And so it happens in our life, sometimes through our lifetime, sometimes if people believe in rebirth or incarnation, maybe through lifetimes, that eventually the game all of a sudden dematerializes. That's it. The awakening, the realization of who we are all of a sudden is there is no going back. Oh, it is a game. And so, of course, you know, the point is like, can you keep that realization, those mystic moments that I think everyone has, everyone, all children have those moments. And everyone throughout their life have them, although sometimes they silence them, although sometimes they don't understand, and sometimes they get scared and they go back to the game. Everyone has those moments. Even if at the moment of dying, sometimes you get those moments. So those moments are there. But why do we decide to stay in the moment or go back to the game? I believe that it takes a lot of maturity to be still part of all these games, also realizing who we truly are. And so there is also the idea that, I mean, it's fun to play these games. And when I say it's fun, I don't only necessarily say that it's fun to play joyful games. I always ask to get understanding of this notion. I ask my students, do you like watching movies? And usually most of them say yes. And so I say, what kind of movies do you like? And I say, I don't know, do you like tragedies. And usually there are, you know, let's say after 25 people, at least 12, 15 say yes. Do you like comedies? Usually there are some that like that. Do you like horror movies? And usually there are, you know, a good amount that likes horror movies. And then I ask, why do you, without judgment, obviously, because that's why they're there. And a lot of people like what they are. You know, some people like a flavor and other people another like another flavor. So why would you like horror movies? And usually get a little embarrassed. They feel that they're judged. I'm not judging you. But for instance, why would you like a horror movie? Because in theory, you know, you don't like to, you know, you don't like, for instance, you probably wouldn't like that in your life. And then it comes out that, you know, there is adrenaline and that there is excitement and suspense and fear can be fun. Children love to be afraid. I live in the States, the Halloween, probably in the UK is big. Yeah. Children love the idea of ghosts and be scared. Why that? Because they're strong emotions. And so our life can also be that. I know a lot of people who love tragedies, who love have constant tragedies in their life. And so, you know, something happened and they can go into the tragedy or they can go into, you know, like readjusting. But they love the strong emotional feel, really, you know, like a deep, deep, you know, like pain, deep pain. It is a strong feeling. So I am at the point where I believe you can play literally almost any game in your life. We can play any game in societies. But the question is, what games do you want to get in an aware sense? Like, if you want to be aware, because again, you can also play the game of ignorance, which is a possible game. A lot of people like the game. I don't know. I'm just going with the flow and I find myself in all these, you know, unbelievable situations. Like, you know, when you go to the park, amusement parks, and you get in the train, and you don't know where you're going to go. It's like, oh, it's scary, but it's fun. That life can be that too. But if you decide not to play the game, if you decide to take charge of your own life, as a human, individual, as a species, as a society, then it becomes harder. Then what do you want? Now, let's play the game that you could actually manifest what you want. What is it you want? And most people don't have a clue what they want. And so that is, again, I'm not judging. It's really, life is what you have and you can do whatever you want with it. But the question is, if you get to the point of starting to have these questions, so it means that you are maybe getting tired of the game. You may be getting tired of the game of pain. You are getting tired of the game of sorrow. You're getting tired of the game of stress. Okay, so those games, you played those, you had some fun, now they are getting old and you're not interested in them anymore. But what is it you want? And so that's when you need silence, you need space. And in that, I would say that we can upgrade our society. Because I can talk to the society I am currently belonging to, and I see in this society a push to constantly doing, never the invitation to undo, do less, stop. It's okay, you got enough PhDs, you got enough post-PhDs, you got enough A+, you got enough money, you got enough wife, husbands, lovers, houses, cars, enough. When enough is enough? And that is a question that is never asked. Socially, at least again, I'm talking the society that I'm being part now for 10 years. In Italy was a little different. I was born in Italy, a little different, but with some similarities. But I don't hear this question from society to students, school children. When is enough? How much do you want to then say stop and enjoy what you have? When is time to undo? When is time to stop? And here I see to the point that, for instance, I bring this example with all compassion and pity. But there was this professor at a university close by where I live in upstate New York and I teach at NYU. But close by there is a university which is very good, is a public university, SUNY. And there was this chemistry professor who really loved what he did. And he kept teaching until the day he died. And so he was in his 80s and he died in front of his students. And so many really think, because like some of his students were traumatized, but, and so I'm sorry about that. But, you know, on his side, he died doing what he loved, but did he die doing what he loved or he didn't? He was never encouraged by his society to say, enough, that's enough, you worked enough. Now take these years to prepare yourself to do nothing. And we are in the current society, we are not so much told that. Again, Zen is a different teaching. I know that not every society is the same, but I see it as a social thirst to instead of pushing for more and more and more, to say also, okay, more and then how much is enough and then less, like ever more of dynamics. Otherwise, you see a lot of unhappiness and people that think that they're going to reach an happiness just to have more and more and more until they die.
Couldn't agree more. And that makes me
Or
think
less.
of, well, I mean, it makes me think of something that you said again very eloquently, very succinctly. Theory per se does not bring change, was a note I made. And so we know this. It's self-evident. It's the problem. It's the disease of the world. And you also quoted one of my favorite lines from Karl Marx. Philosophers have only interpreted the world, or the points to change it. How do we seed this kind of change? Fully aware of the fact that it's totally out of our control whether anything grows from the seed, but.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so I was mentioning at the beginning of our conversation that I started to write this book during the pandemic. And during the pandemic, it was for me, it became a really deep existential moment of my life that pushed me to the core of my own honesty, existential honesty. I was in the US when, everything froze. At the time, there was, the COVID at the time was just in China. And then, the second country was really hit was Italy. And I did have a lot of students from China who was telling me how the situation was there. And then I had a lot of family in Italy who were telling me how the situation was there. And then I was living in a situation where it was denied. I was at the time in New York and there was a denial going on. It's like, oh, don't worry, just do everything like it is. It's nothing happening. I was like, oh, this is going to be intense. And then, of course, the next country was the US. And so I was in, like everyone during the lockdown, you didn't know if your family, whatever they were, or friends were going to survive you. And you could just pretty much silence your mind and try to meditate, or people who believe in God maybe prayed. There was not much more to do than that. And in my case, I really had to face my own life, which I always did in my life, by the way. I always take the time to stop and say, am I doing really what I want to do? I was lucky enough to study Nietzsche when I was 16 year old. And that exercise of the eternal recurrence of the same, where he says, act like your life was going to come back exactly the same, like nothing different, forever and ever, ever. And so, would you say yes to that life? And that really helped me in my life, because whenever I was not sure, should I do this or not, I would think of that exercise and I say, well, if I wouldn't like to live this, forever, then I rather, do something else. And so, I always try to be very honest to myself and knowing that, in my own perception, my life is my work of art. And so, I want to enjoy what I am unfolding. So during the pandemic, I had to stop, and at the time it was post-humanism. I was super involved with the community. I've been already, part of this discussion for many years. I really believed in it, and I was like, okay, so I am into this philosophy, but is this philosophy helping me right now? Because if a philosophy doesn't help you in a deep existential crisis, what is the point of any philosophy? In fact, I really like philosophy in the ancient term as a love for wisdom, philos, sophia. In ancient Greek, philos, love, sophia, wisdom. Some people like to reverse and say the wisdom of love, but it's still the same idea, love of wisdom, wisdom of love. So if a philosophy doesn't help you, what is the point? Don't call it philosophy, call it theory. And I never saw posthumanism as just a theory, although it is also a theory. But I always saw it as a philosophy. To me, it was always very clear. That's why I wrote the book Philosophical Posthumanism. So I had to face myself, okay, is this helping me right now in this big existential crisis? And I really went deep into that, like I think a lot of my colleagues did too. And I think that the people who approached posthumanism just as a theory, they didn't find much out of it. I saw a lot of depression at the time within the community as well. I saw some people who didn't see meaning. They didn't find the meaning within that. My answer was very different. I really opened the philosophy, and I found meaning. It actually even helped me to understand that this virus that was considered the enemy was not the enemy, was something that was apparent. We will never know the full story, but it was part of non-human animals. And then because of humans keeping, enlarging our spaces, we, going to territories that we should just leave to non-human animals to get to give also them some spaces. And so some of these viruses, of course, are going to become part of the human species. I started to learn about viruses. And also a lot of viruses are a part of our genetic makeup. The way, for instance, the placenta is formed when we are in the belly is out of a retrovirus action that, you know, we went through much back in history of the humankind. So I started to really understand the virus not as the enemy. And if anything, the enemy was, again, the anthropocentric approach where we can take more and more land that at the moment are mostly the habitat of non-human animals. And of course, those viruses are going to, you know, enter the human species. And so it really helped me to be at peace on some level with what was happening. Of course, you know, like it was a very challenging time, I think, for everyone, but it did help me a lot. And so writing this book at the time, the idea of posthumanism just as a theory was gone for me, was dead. I didn't care anymore. Before that, I could also embrace it as a theory. I come from academia. I've been teaching academia for a long time. And I was okay for posthumanism to also be just that. But after that, I'm not generalizing for everyone. And I know that even now, for some people, posthumanism can be just a theory. But after the pandemic, for me, it was done. It was no longer the case. Posthumanism could not be just a theory. I didn't care about that. I didn't want to spend any minute of my life anymore supporting something that could be just a theory, just a game of the mind. I didn't care about that because that game of the mind would not help me in my everyday life. And so to me, the turn was fully existential. And I would say that probably existential posthumanism comes from the pandemic when the turn was clear. It was no longer just philosophical posthumanism. Now it was existential. And it became a way to really unravel reality, address reality, not just like a picture of reality, but a reality that you are reality. The reality is not just there for you, like Marx says, to see it from an external perspective, but you are completely it. And being that, you can change it because change is happening and always. Right now I'm changing. My body from yesterday is different. Some cells are dying, some cells are reborn. Who I am right now is different from who I was yesterday, from who I was 10 years ago, from who I was 20 years ago. So everything is changing no matter what. So at this point, I can embrace change. I can embrace changes. I am change. And so I can also envision and manifest what I want to manifest, being that I am that. And so that's when I really go back to the point of intention that goes to everything. What is our intention with technology? What is our intention as a species? What is our intention as part of this cosmos? And to me now, these are really good questions because it is true that some people are, you know, just seeing technology as the savior. Now that some people are not believing in Christ anymore, but now we have, you know, the Google. Other people are seeing the opposite. Oh, now technology is taking over. Technology is bad. But I'm asking these people, but what is it you want? And it's always really hard to get an answer because people like to be afraid or to fear something. But once you get them out of that paradigm and you ask, okay, leave that paradigm alone for a moment and just play with me. Am I now asking you? Okay, so told that all these bad things can happen, but what is it you want? I'm not asking what is that you don't want to happen. That is very clear. You don't want that to happen. But what is that you want in a positive way that can give you joy, that can give you happiness? And most people don't know what to say to that question. So to me now, that my work socially is bringing these questions and asking these questions. And it is very interesting that often there is no answer. I was in this beautiful conference in Bangalore, which is the Silicon Valley of Asia in India. And so we were in this conference and we were presenting the book and we were talking about technology. And so the room was full of people, was a mix of academic people and people who are developing AI. And so we're talking about technology. And at the moment, one of the main drivers of technology is profit. And so I'm not against profit, but I'm asking, is profit enough to be the main drive of technology when technology is not just coding algorithms, is coding our society, is literally coding the youth, is shaping the way we are interacting, is literally coding the human species. So when we think in these big frames, is profit enough? And also brought example, for instance, of young children being exposed way too soon to devices. And when we know through a lot of research done at Stanford University in California that the same part of the brain that is active with a technological addiction is the same part of the brain that is active with the use of cocaine. And so the question is like, we would never give cocaine to a child because, you know, it's really bad for them. We would go to jail, it's a big deal. But we, you know, as a society feel that it's okay to give an iPod to a 6-month-year-old when they're learning to say iPod before mom. And so the question is, yeah, we are making profit out of these children, but is profit enough? I mean, you are giving something that can be on some level chemistry, talking, be compared to cocaine. And this is still legal. I think it's going to be changing soon, but it's still legal. So is profit enough? And I said, you know, with no judgment, no one is judging anyone. But I ask all of you, because, you know, some of you are dependent on technology, a lot of you are working on technology, studying technology. I'm asking you out of all sincerity, without judging anyone, do you think that profit is enough as the main drive of technology? And if you think so, just raise your hand. I'm just curious. Now, I don't know, maybe because they, you know, felt that they could be judged or anything, but no one raises their hands. No one. No one raised their hands. But still, this is what's happening. There is no, I mean, it's starting to shift. But I think it's surreal that just people who are learning how to program are programming these algorithms that then are being used by policing forces, by governments. And I was checking the program here in at Zurich University of people who are actually doing computer sciences, because I thought, oh, maybe it could be interesting for them, you know, like to propose something about posthumanism. And I couldn't believe that they had no courses on philosophy of technology, ethics, society, nothing, just coding. It's like, you are creating the issue. The way we think in such departments that are so separated, people who are coding society, they don't know anything about society. How is that possible? So I am an educator. I really believe education is one of the main forces of rejuvenating society. And I see that, you know, we have a big response/ability. I believe in that. That's why I am in this field and I've been in this field and I'm still in this field. But I also feel that we need to get out of the ivory tower. We need to get out of academia, stay in academia, but also speak outside of academia and really without judgment, without, you know, fear, but really connecting and bringing awareness. Because Zuckerberg also was in that society where, you know, after the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal, he was also in the society where specific political outcomes came out of this big experiment where, you know, some people got elected instead of others. He still was part of that society. So there is no way you can just separate, say, oh, I'm just, you know, profiting from these companies doing this experiment, but I am going to be my ivory tower in some, you know, different planet. We are all in this together. We are one species. And we should talk about that in diversity, in awareness, if we want. And if we don't want, again, can be the game of ignorance, can be the game of the end of the species, it's all good. But at least, you know, like just be aware that that's what we are choosing.
Thank you, Francesca. You've led me, though, to one final question that I have to ask, which is, what do you want? You want to talk about these things, but personally speaking, what's your vision? And to put it even more sort of succinctly, you know, if the post-human way of seeing has come about because of a limitation in previous ways of seeing, what would it be like to get beyond that, to be post-human, to be able to put all this talk behind us? What would that world look like? How could you envision it for us?
Thank you so much, Daniel. Yeah, I think it's like, you know, when you have your room or your home and you're clean it really deeply one day and you do an amazing job, you put some incense and flowers, the place looks amazing. And then 1 week later, the room is a mess again. You know, dust is everywhere. And so you realize that there is no way that one person or one community or one time is going to take care of everything. I like, for instance, the three gods in the Hindu, there are many, but I like that there is Brahman, the creator, and then there is Vishnu, the maintainer, and then there is Shiva, the destroyer. Because this aspect of maintaining something is often not, doesn't get really highlighted. We get a lot of highlights about, create your own life, be the artist of your own life, be original, be yourself. Great, fantastic. Or, for instance, get rid of what you don't want, move on, declutter, deconstruct. Great. But what in between? Once that you created, or once that you have destroyed, what is that other elements which we don't talk much? For instance, the job of housewives have not been ever remunerated because that aspect is never really acknowledged. And I started to acknowledge, it's interesting, I was in India recently for this conference, and then the organizer kindly took us around for this amazing 2 days of really getting in tune and knowing the region. So they took us all to all these temples, and actually it was during the Shivaratri, which is a big festival in India, and it was amazing. Thousands of people, pilgrims, walking barefoot from one temple to the other. And so I was in this, I was going to get something home, and there were all these beautiful deities. And I thought, I saw this deity, I thought it was a goddess. And I asked, is this a goddess? And a colleague was said, yes, I got it. And then we are in the car, and another colleague says, well, that's Vishnu, it's not a goddess, it's a god. It's like, really? And who is, they told me more about Vishnu. I knew about Vishnu, but I never really embraced Vishnu in my life. I like all traditions. I'm not Hindu, I'm not Buddhist, I'm all of them. I'm Hindu, I'm Muslim, I'm Christian, I'm atheist, I'm all of them. I think, as we were mentioning before, that in the end, who we truly are is coming through all these traditions. So it doesn't matter which path you take. So I like to embrace, in my home there are all images, if I can, I would put anything just to, to a recognition of all these traditions in humankind. And so it's very interesting that Vishnu actually now is in my home and made me think a lot, like, for instance, when I have to pay my bills. And that has never been a moment of joy. Oh, I have to pay bills. But now I try to think of, okay, but that one is my work now. Because of course I love, it is a lot of work, but I love to write my book. I love to have conversations with you. I love to take my walks or to have even, my times with family members. But what about paying the bills? What about dealing with the super high bill that was not correct and that you have to make these thousands of phone calls and there is always someone else and they don't know what it is and it becomes these loops. And I started to try to realize that that is part of the maintenance aspect of at least this dimension. Probably doesn't have to be that way, but it is like that at the moment. We can transform it, but it is the way it is at the moment. And so what should we do? I believe that there is not one time or one person or one savior or one that is going to take care of everything forever. If that would happen, it would be the end of the cycle. And so it was the first year I was teaching at NYU, was 2014, 10 years ago, and I was teaching ancient philosophy. And I teach at Global Studies, Liberal Studies, Global Studies. And it's beautiful because I can only do tradition that come from all over the world. I cannot do just one tradition, either Eastern or West. I have to teach them all. And so I was teaching Buddhism. And one student asked me this question. He asked me, so what if everyone got enlightened at the same time? Mm-hmm. And it really was like, oh, what a great question. And said, I don't know, this answer. He also asked what Buddhists would say about that. But let me look into that. And so I did some research, and apparently, again, there are a lot of texts written hundreds of years after the Buddha died, the historical Buddha died. But, some of these texts would say that he actually was asked the same question, and he would just say, like, don't even go into, that, he would say, like, it's not something that's going to happen. It's like you kind of stay with what you have. Don't go into, like Zen said, don't go too much into the movie of the mind. So I get that answer, but I was not fully happy. And then year after year, this question kept, staying in my mind. And one day I was like, of course, if everyone got enlightened, the whole game would end. And of course, probably it would eventually start another game, another cosmos, another yuga, the cycles and recycles of the universe. And that actually, scientifically speaking, in cosmology now, they're also embracing the idea of the cycles of the universe, that one universe eventually dies and another one is born out of, call it the fragments of that universe. So I would say that there is no final vision in any way. What we can do is, you asked me what I want. I know what I want for my own self, for my own individual Francesca, is doing less. I'm trying to really do less. I think like a couple of months ago after the writing of this book, which was way too intense. I spent 5 years, but the last 2 years were really nonstop. I was working on it nonstop. I got an indigestion of action with that book. I was literally working on it all day long. I got an indigestion and I love the book, but it was enough is enough. So after the book, you know, I went back to teaching, but my own personal goal is trying to do less. So I'm really trying to say yes to, you know, I'm taking my time. I'm trying to be less obsessive about, you know, replying emails. I'm trying to do less. So that's my own goal as a person. As a part of this humanity or of this planet, my goal is a goal of kind of bringing awareness to who is ready to hear. Because you can be in any game. You can be in the game of war, in the game of violence. There are so many games you could play. But in my life, I know that those are not games that I like. And no games that I want to experience, and no games that I want to see around myself. So my own game is bringing, you know, like my own awareness about that we don't need war, for instance. War is a new game that started late Neolithic and it became a real thing during the Iron Ages. So it's really new in the history of humankind. But then it gets normalized through specifically, for instance, education. Sometimes education can become indoctrination and giving you the idea that war is normal. It's not. So I'm trying to, you know, to do this, but with joy. I'm doing it because if we do it with anger, if we do it with judgment, if we do it with stress, then it's the same cycle. It doesn't matter what you're saying. I can talk about peace with anger and I'm creating war. In that sense, I think Yatan again, the seeds of war are everywhere, even in someone who might be speaking about peace. So I'm trying to really, you know, bring back to the idea that it doesn't matter what we do because it, at the end of the day, is the game that we are living. But what is the game that we want to live? And to me, as a species, we can understand that war is a game that we don't need anymore because there is no one who wins out of a war. And I remember my grandmother, she lived through two world wars, the first one as a child and the second one as an adult. And I remember she had never been political. She didn't even tell me if she voted for a republic or monarchy during the shift in Italy, although she let me understand that she actually voted for Republic, but it was politics were such a huge thing during her time. She could be killed for what she thought, that she really always stayed very silent about politics. And so she was never in the political in that sense. But I remember I was visiting her. It was me and her, her and me, and I was around 16 year old, I think. And it was during the Iraq war. And so we were eating and the news came out, and the news was that US was attacking Iraq. And she was always been very, you know, grateful to the US because when she experienced being a child and there was, you know, the time after war, nothing, you know, there was no food. And she remembered the Americans bringing food and clothes. So just that human memory of someone with a smile, someone who would give you something, with asking nothing back. She always said, remember that you are alive because of the Americans. So she was grateful. She never had any anti-American feelings. But when she heard about US attacking Iraq, She stopped. She's blind look in her face. She looked at me and she was serious, deadly serious. She said, like, never again, war, never again. If you live through a war, you will never want to experience that again. Not matter if you win or you lose, there is no winner in a war. You just, they have to stop the war right now. It was so powerful for her who lived the war. And all my grandparents did. And so they had a lot of stories. So I didn't, you know, if, you know, my life, the experience of war, but I know deep in me that something that I don't believe in, there is never a solution. And so the fact that we have normalized that as a possible solution, that to me is a disease, is when we are at outside of the ease as a species. That is a wrong teaching that is creating suffering and poverty and misery that is very unnecessary. So, you know, what I want on a personal level, having more space to undo, more serenity of like, you know, just enjoy whatever it is, even paying a bill, enjoying that. And then on the other side as a species, being aware of where we are at, being aware that we don't need to go into games that are kind of new and that just bring, you know, pain and death, because those are games that you can possibly play, but I really don't want to play them personally. And I know that a lot of people don't, but they think that it's inevitable. And so bringing this notion of inevitability out of some of these diseases. No, we don't need to rape each other. No, we don't need to kill each other. No, we don't need to be at war with each other. We don't need any of that. Really zero. And I believe in that. I really believe in that. It is an unlearning. It's going to take some time. But then the point is that do we want it or not? Because I think apart from the economic interest of war, I think a lot of people enjoy war, give adrenaline, and is the journey of absolute power towards someone else. You know, kill them, rape them, drink the blood. So you know, unless we understand that killing and raping you're doing to yourself, then I don't know if people would be okay with that, realizing that they're not just killing the other, they're killing themselves. So it is deep, but I really believe that we can unlearn a lot of these patterns as a species. And that is my current game.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I wonder then, finally, just as a concluding thought, is that the essence of what actually makes us human, this ability to choose this destiny, to bring this kind of awareness to a situation and to weigh things up? We don't know the inner life of other beings, but that does seem to be, you know, something that is available to us, and that we neglect at our peril. So I wonder if that might be the post-human taken to its limit would be to come back into our true humanity and take responsibility.
That's a good question. In fact, some people say, have we always been post-human? And I would say yes. I think that this perception of who we are is really atemporal. It doesn't necessarily come from this specific spatial temporal condition. What comes out of this specific spatial temporal condition is realizing what do we need to realize right now, which is specifically, I would say, you know, this disconnection from, for instance, ecology. While technology is the new God, ecology is something just that we can, you know, take advantage of. So I think that this is an understanding that is probably very specific to our being human right now, that we need right now, again, if we want to survive as a species. On the other side, this idea that, you know, is that what makes us human? I would say yes, if you think of the human more from, for instance, shamanistic traditions. I'm thinking, for instance, of Amerindian cosmologies. But it's not only specific to these cosmologies. It's something that is shared to all shamanistic traditions. And humans, the original belief, spiritual belief of all humans actually were shamanistic. That goes through all continents. And for instance, I'm thinking specifically of the work of Vivero de Castro. And Vivero de Castro, who is this Brazilian scholar, studied deeply the Amerindian tribes, and he describes the shaman in this understanding through a native epistemologies, cosmic epistemologies. The shaman is the trans-species being. So in this tradition, the human is seen just as one possible perspective. So for instance, I am part of a culture that I understand. I am understanding your language, because you are embodying something that I am also recognizing. But for instance, an ant is part of the ant culture, as specific perspective, something that we would never, you know, if I see, I don't know, some a good plate of pasta, and I get, oh, I'm getting really hungry, oh, that is going to taste so good. And maybe for an ant is a little tiny tiny insect, a tiny dead insect, and they feel like, that's going to be so delicious. But are the same emotions on some level. So there is this shared, if you want to call it consciousness, or if you want to call it awareness, through Visargadatta Maharaj, who was more of an Advaita Vedanta philosopher. But so that is like, okay, we are coming from a specific perspective, but that potentiality of choosing, of realizing, of creativity, of poiesis, is really anywhere, any perspective. It can be even technological perspective. We didn't go so much into that discussion of techno-awareness or techno-consciousness, but there is really no way to stop it. In fact, going to Nisargadatta Maharaj, he makes a difference between consciousness and awareness. And so consciousness is something that is shared. For instance, human consciousness is shared by us as a species, if you want, or ants consciousness, or plants consciousness. But then there is this other level that there is no way you can, you know, you can live. It is awareness. And it's really everywhere, is in being, is non-being, is there is no way to stop that. And in that sense, I would say that this possibility of choosing, of realizing, I think it's part of the poetic aspect of existence that is present from a snowflake to the tangling of the wires, of electric wires in your room. It's really everywhere. And then there is the coding aspect. Can we understand that? Can we perceive that as such? And in that, it's some people who get a little more part of a culture, maybe they can only realize, for instance, human arts, and maybe they don't see beaver work as engineering or as possible work of art.
Yeah.
But I would say that and the shaman is the trans-species being. So the shaman is the one who never forgot that they are not just human. And so that's why they can talk, for instance, to the plants. And for instance, in ayahuasca ceremonies, they can ask the plant, can I drink you? Can you teach me? Can you become part of me? Can I learn from you? But only the shaman, because the shaman is human, but is not limited to the human perspective. So in that sense, I would say, yes, it's humans have that, but I would say it's probably the key to manifest in every dimension. I don't believe there is only one, and this is not the multiverse, if you think also through quantum physics, but I think the spark of manifestation is specifically that aspect of creativity. And so even if we decide not to have agency, that itself is a choice. And I would say that it probably goes beyond any level of species or biology. I think it's probably the key to dimensional unfolding.
Back to intention, back to awareness, back to the existential dilemma in some ways of, you know, what game are we going to play? Thank you, Francesca. It's been a really
Daniel,
rich conversation.
What game do you want to play? Wait. What game do you want to play?
Well, that's a good one. I guess right now the game I want to play is switching off the machine and powering down, because I got to get in the car and then I got to get on the plane. So unfortunately, we'll have to come back and continue for part two. But in simple terms, I think, you know, a lot of what you said resonates. I mean, it's to tune in better actually to my own personal needs, but also to the need around me, and to see that as actually not different to my need. And there's a lot of suffering in the world, there's a lot of suffering I've experienced in my own limited experience of life, and at the same time there's a lot of potential for healing. And yeah, the sort of the flow between those two possibilities is quite alive, I think, and finding a way to be I guess moving out of the suffering towards healing is what I try and navigate by, and that's my guiding star, let's say. So thank you again, a real pleasure, and I hope to continue the conversation.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for your work, for your insights, and have a wonderful journey to wherever you're going. And then we are in this journey together. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.